Hello. Tonight I'm going to look at Blake's later mystical writings, which are among the most challenging and obscure works in English literature. In Auguries of Innocence, Blake famously says, "To see the world in a grain of sand, and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." Minute particulars, in other words, are the starting point for a universal vision. This is an important idea in Blake, and it's this idea that produced the wonderful clarity and directness of the Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience. Those early poems feel as if they're aimed at an audience. But as he advanced into middle age, Blake seems to have lost hope of achieving a popular readership. In 1797, at the age of 50, he started work on a vast allegorical poem entitled Vala, which is spelled V-E-L-E. He later renamed it The Four Zoas, with a subtitle, The Torments of Love and Jealousy and the Death and Judgment of Albion. Evidently, this is a long way from the Songs of Innocence and Experience. The difficulty for the reader is that you have a statement early on, Los was the fourth immortal starry one, and you don't know who Los is. You're given a cloudy, grandiose idea. The next lines are, A bright universe empery attended day and night, days and nights of revolving joy. Arthona was his name. It's this high-flown quality that makes the Four Zoas so difficult to follow. You feel as though Blake was really writing for himself, and if the unfamiliar names are confusing, he doesn't offer much help. What are the natures of those living creatures the Heavenly Father only knoweth? No individual knoweth nor can know in all eternity. That's from Vala, Night the First. So what does it all mean? The Four Zoas are four allegorical beasts competing with the spirit of Albion, who is the ancient ancestor of England. And to make sense of the Four Zoas, as with other late work by Blake, you need a glossary beside you as you're reading, so that you can check and see that Los is a metal worker and a prophet who stands for the imagination. Orc is the spirit of love, emotion and pleasure. Urizen is the rational principle which has become a tyrant. The fourth Zoa, Tharmas, is a vague being that stands for the unifying principle of instinct or personality. If only it were that simple. Unfortunately, each of these allegorical figures has a different name depending on whether they are in their ideal state or in their fallen state. Los is sometimes Arthona and Orc is sometimes Lover and so on. What Blake is doing is poetically examining the contrast between what man ought to be and what he is. Man should consist of wisdom, love, imagination and strength, but in his decayed condition he is torn apart by hypocrisy, lust, rage and confusion. But there's another layer of meaning that relates to the condition of England at the time. I'll come back to that later. As you can imagine, The Four Zoas has never been a popular poem, and it's clearly the product of a completely isolated sensibility. By the time he began working on it, Blake had resigned himself to living out his days in complete obscurity. This is ironic and rather tragic, of course, because during his last four decades of his life, from, say, the 1790s until the end of the 1820s, English poetry reached an unparalleled pitch of creativity and imaginative richness. It also became a rare thing for poetry, culturally significant. Poets like Byron and Wordsworth became wealthy and famous, and their works were read by every cultivated person in the English-speaking world. English poetry hadn't seen anything like it since Shakespeare's time, and there's been nothing like it since. And right at the centre of this amazing creative explosion in the middle of London is this unknown voice, Blake, who some would say is a more powerful and more profound poet than Wordsworth, Keats, Shelley and Byron. But at the time he was barely recognised. Wordsworth transcribed four of the Songs of Innocence into his notebooks, but there's no evidence that he owned a copy of the book. And Coleridge was aware of him, but wasn't particularly impressed even by the masterpiece, The Tiger, or by London. So Blake the poet was, in modern parlance, a terrible underachiever. This was partly because of his indifference to material success, and partly because he was regarded principally as an artist. We have to remember that the poems weren't printed in book form as they are now. They were engraved in longhand, as it were, surrounded by Blake's vivid and idiosyncratic designs, so that made them harder to appreciate. Unable to achieve success through his writing, Blake relied on a small group of admirers and patrons who did what they could to help him. One of these was the Swiss-German painter Henry Fuseli. Blake and Fuseli first met as a result of a business deal. Fuseli needed an engraver, and Blake, who lived nearby, got the job. They became friends, and they liked to indulge in bouts of sarcastic teasing. Blake wrote about Fuseli, the only man that e'er I knew who did not make me almost spew, which isn't one of his greatest couplets, but it shows an earthy comedic side to Blake that doesn't always come across. Fuseli had the potential to be of great assistance to Blake. He was a member of the Royal Academy, a distinction Blake never achieved, and it's interesting to consider why not, given that he was a talented and highly original artist who enjoyed the support of eminent artist friends. We know that it wasn't just his odd manners that made him unacceptable. The Academy had no objection to mavericks. In fact, Fuseli himself had a rebellious streak. When he was told that the boat was too small in a painting, The Miracle of the Loaves and Fishes, he said, "That's part of the miracle." But this is a sort of drawing room eccentricity which would pass as charm. Blake's abnormalities were rather more disturbing, and instead of concealing them, he revelled in them. Peter Ackroyd's definitive biography of Blake includes a fascinating snippet of dialogue which shows us what he was like in real life. He just finished a new painting and he was showing it to Fuseli, who said, "Now someone has told you this is very fine." And Blake says, "Yes, the Virgin Mary appeared to me and told me it was very fine." What can you say to that? And Fuseli jokes, "Her ladyship has not an immaculate taste." So clearly Blake lacked any real sense of social decorum. One can easily imagine the Royal Academy's reluctance to welcome this unpredictable lunatic who talked in religious visions. Blake was a lifelong devotee of the mystic Emanuel Swedenborg, one of the leading radical theologians of the 18th century. Swedenborg believed that when a man dies, he ascends into his spiritual body, where he existeth in perfect form. He also believed that heaven and hell were expressions of human appetites and desires, which is a very Blakean idea. Like Blake, Swedenborg claimed to be able to converse with angels. That makes him sound like a madman or a fraud. But we have to remember that the religious landscape in the 18th century was more varied and flexible than it is now. There were numerous cults and movements offering fresh interpretations of Christianity, and Blake was naturally drawn to these new religious ideas. According to his earliest biographer, Gilchrist, he had a particular enthusiasm for the Indian gymnosophists, or naked philosophers, who were supposed to be wiser than the rest of mankind. And one of Blake's close friends, Thomas Butts, liked to tell the story of calling on Blake's house one day and finding William and Catherine sitting in the summer house naked, or as he puts it, freed from those troublesome disguises that have prevailed since the fall. Butts wanted to leave them to it, but Blake called out, "Come in, it's only Adam and Eve," as if they'd been reading Milton's Paradise Lost and getting into character. There was another factor holding Blake back, of course, and that was class. The religious radicals that he supported were strongly associated with the lower class of London tradesmen. And even as a tradesman, Blake wasn't particularly prosperous, nor did he have any social ambitions. He'd married a maid, and they kept no servants. A great contrast to, say, the landed Lord Byron and the Etonian Percy Shelley, who refined their poetic sensibilities on endless grand tours, or as house guests of the European nobility. Very occasionally Blake pops up in letters and diaries kept by members of London society. He did attend a dinner party given by one of Byron's ex-lovers, Lady Caroline Lamb, and was described there as a man who looked careworn and subdued, but his countenance radiated as he spoke of his favourite pursuits. And his favourite pursuits, as he grew older, included his prophetic, allegorical, and, as I've said, often impenetrable writings. Coming back to the four Zoas, which Blake worked on for many years, making changes, revisions, and additions. The four Zoas is written in a very loose kind of blank verse. This can work well, of course. Walt Whitman, who was influenced by the authorised version of the Bible, created some very arresting verse forms like this. But Blake's attempts here feel like a prosaic kind of free verse. A lot of it is just fulminous ranting. In human forms distinct they stood round Urizen, Prince of Light, petrifying all the human imagination into rock and sand. Groans ran along Tyburn's brook and along the river of Oxford and among the Druid temples. Albion groaned in Tyburn's brook. Albion gave his loud death groan. Blake was against capital punishment, and of course people were still being publicly hanged in his day at Tyburn, at the western end of what is now Oxford Street. Hence the expression to go west. But this line, petrifying all the human imagination into rock and sand, is not very good verse, I'm afraid. And quite apart from the literary form, it's his decision to create a wholly new mythology that makes the poem impenetrable. In one of his early manuscripts, there's a list of the names of God written in various languages, which is interesting because it suggests Blake was trying to unravel the religious principle, even at an early age, to get to the heart of it, and he was preparing himself to create his own system, his own pantheon, as he's doing here. It's a pity he's so virulently opposed to traditional Greek and Latin myths. In his poem Milton, he complains that both Milton and Shakespeare were curbed by what he calls the general malady and infection from the silly Greek and Latin slaves of the sword. But if he'd used Greek and Latin models, the mythology of the four Zoas would be a lot more accessible and people might have had a chance to hear what Blake is saying about the condition of the country at the time. What is the price of experience? Do men buy it for a song? Or wisdom for a dance in the street? No, it is bought with the price of all that a man hath, his house, his wife, his children. This is the preacher in Blake, and it's one of the rare moments of real power in the poem. Perhaps the most serious attempt to interpret and understand the four Zoas was made by W.B. Yeats. He transcribed the manuscript and co-authored a major three-volume study of Blake's mystical writings. He even contacted the descendants of Blake's printer called Linnell, and they were very ancient people, and they served him ancient port, which must have been an intriguing encounter. Yeats's aim was to prove that Blake wasn't mad and clear up that riddle forever. But even with Yeats's backing, I don't think Valo of the Four Zoas works. Blake's long prophetic work, Milton, a Poem in Two Books, features one of the best-known odes in the English language. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among those dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. It's extraordinary, really, and paradoxical that Blake, who was deeply opposed to the established church and to the hierarchies that supported it, wrote this poem, which is the ultimate expression of all kinds of English institutions, not just the church, but public schools, the British establishment, the system of political power, and the monarchy. It's almost the national anthem. I suspect Blake would have wept to know what his poem had become. But there's an odd Blakean quality to the degree of fame the poem enjoys. It's anonymously famous, by which I mean that it's known and sung by people who probably couldn't name the author. Certainly if you take popularity as your yardstick, it's the greatest poem of the entire Romantic period. But it wouldn't have been one of the hymns Blake sang on his deathbed. When he knew his time was coming, he approached death exactly as he had approached his life, optimistically, spiritually, and on his own terms. He said to his wife, "I glory in dying. I have no grief but in leaving you, Catherine. We have lived happy and we have lived long. We have been ever together, but we shall be divided soon. Why should I fear death? Nor do I fear it. I have endeavoured to live as Christ commands, and have sought to worship truly my own house when I was not seen of men." It's a very moving deathbed scene, where he sings hallelujahs and songs of joy and triumph. Blake died aged 69 on August the 12th, 1827, at 6 p.m. He was buried in Bunhill Fields in London alongside his spiritual forebear, the dissenter John Bunyan, author of Pilgrim's Progress. And from his death, Blake's pilgrimage as a famous poet began.